Our next speaker is Kim Sengupta, who's a defence and diplomatic correspondent for the Independent newspaper. Kim's one of the journalists who's really contributed to giving readers of the Independent a better picture and understanding of the war machine. Those journalists also include Robert Fisk and Patrick Coben, of course. I haven't got a book to plug for you, so I'll ask you just to give us your thoughts. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you. Hi. I was last in Iraq about 2 weeks ago for the 5th anniversary of the start of the invasion. And before that, in November, in Basra, Baghdad, Tikrit, Mosul. Now, it's a very fluid situation there at the moment, and it's undoubtedly the case that there are parts of Baghdad which one can move around more safely now than before, thanks to General Petraeus' search. Now, that's not entirely surprising, because Baghdad, as you, some of you may know, is a fairly small city, and if you pour 30,000 troops into a city that small, it's bound to have an effect. And of course, those troops will go back sooner or later, although I gather that President Bush is going to announce either today or possibly tomorrow, it may have done today, that the withdrawal from Baghdad, from Iraq rather, the surge numbers will not take place now, which is a recommendation of General Petraeus, which just shows the fragility of the situation now, that the whole thing is being, the gains which have been made, and there have been gains made, is being held together with a huge number of troops and armament. There's another price which has been paid for the relative stability, which is that Baghdad is now entirely a city divided. Those of you who went there before the war may remember a place which was actually fairly mixed. Certainly, where we stay, we don't stay inside the Green Zone, we stay in a place called Karada, a hotel in Karada. You know, that was a very mixed area, as you know. It was, you know, Shia, Sunni, and Christians as well. Well, there are no mixed areas left now in Baghdad. They have been separated by blast walls. The Americans have formalized the separation. And that, in a way, has helped bring down the number of sectarian killings. But the corollary of that is that you have got, you know, communities which used to be together in the past, now separate. You know, the separation has been formalized with the blast walls and barbed wire. And there have been incidents, certainly, you know, people that we know, who couples who have divorced because there's no prospect of them living together now in one place. And this is undoubtedly basically storing up trouble for the future. Because if you look at Northern Ireland, 30 years on, 10 years after a relative peace, you know, the walls are still up there. And now the walls being put up in Baghdad are dividing communities. You're not going to get that many intermarriages between Shias and Sunnis in the future, because they simply will not grow up together. They, you know, probably will not meet each other. So that is, you know, one of the many prices being paid by the Iraqi people, thanks to liberation. The both Becky and Lindsay mentioned the statue of Saddam being pulled down in Ferdy Square. It's obviously a, you know, very iconic image. I was in Ferdy Square on that day. Was it a grand conspiracy with the Americans? Well, I don't think so. It wasn't entirely spontaneous either. Some of the people there were local. Some had been bussed in from Sadr City, which used to be called Saddam City in those days. The whole thing actually became quite farcical, because it was a, you know, quite a hefty statue, and they couldn't pull it down. And eventually had to bring in this thing called the Hercules, which is used to salvage 75-ton tanks, battle tanks, and that went up the steps of the plinth and pulled down the statue. There was an American flag put on the face of the statue, first of all. That was pulled down, actually, at the instructions of an American Marine colonel who was standing next to me, called Colonel Brian McCoy, and then that hastily found Iraqi flag to put in his place. A lot of the American Marines were quite upset when McCoy suggested that the American flag be removed. And McCoy also, I remember, said to me and several others that evening, that unless American troops leave within the next 6 months, the country will degenerate into a long insurgency. And how right he was. Nick will undoubtedly go into the way the war was sold over here. I am not really qualified to say that. I actually wasn't here in London in the run-up to the war, and I haven't got Nick's breadth of knowledge on this. What my experience was, I was in Baghdad at the time. I was covering the inspections by the two teams from Hans Blix and Mohamed El Baradei. And what became quite apparent was that the inspections, which were meant to be about, was after all the crux of the case against Saddam, that is WMD, the inspections, should have resulted in working out whether or not they existed. But you soon realized, those of us in Baghdad, that this was actually a bit of a joke. Because it's nice to come back from Baghdad to London and see people in the Foreign Office, in the MOD, my fellow journalists, and there was absolutely no doubt whatsoever that they were preparing for war. And we realized that what we were going through in Baghdad was a rather silly sideshow. The guy who led the Hans Blix team, I was just telling Nick earlier on, Dimitri Perikos, was in Iraq in the mid-90s, and I always get confused between Anvik or Anskom, but he was there in the mid-90s when there was certainly a deception by the regime, and he arrived in 2002 in quite a hawkish stance and determined to find chemical biological weapons if they were there. But I remember the farewell dinner given by Dimitri Perikos just before they left, before the invasion, when he said very bitterly that they, i.e. the Americans and the British, will not let him and his team finish the mission because they will not like what they find or not find. So Dimitri left and the team left, and the Canal Hotel, they were blown up a few months later, killing a lot of people. What I found extraordinary at the time was that when we tried to say to people back here that the inspectors were not being stopped by the regime, and that's not because Saddam's regime suddenly became nice people, it's because they were terrified of what might happen. Well, what they're terrified of did happen, you know, they got invaded. But they really weren't much covert or overt attempt to stop the inspections. But when I tried to say that, I remember not only were we quite robustly attacked by the government, but also quite curiously by some fellow journalists who were getting their briefings from government sources in here and the US, and their view was those of us in Baghdad had somehow gone native and had been brainwashed. And one little thing I remember quite vividly was the day the dossier, what became known as the dodgy dossier, came out. We were in Baghdad, we were staying at the time in the Rashid Hotel, and we got the dossier from the internet, and we then spoke to Tariq Aziz and said we wanted to see some of the sites which the dossier claims were being used for the manufacture of chemical and biological weapons, and we were taken to those sites, which we chose. Now, it's obviously the case that, you know, we were not experts, we were not scientists, and you know, what we did see or did not see was very subjective and not comprehensive, and we were very, very careful writing that. I remember with my friend Ian McCaskill from The Guardian sitting down, and you know, we saying to each other that we must put that caveat in that we are not qualified to judge whether or not there was WMD, and we wrote, I thought, you know, fairly sort of neutral pieces. But what was interesting was the reaction from Alistair Campbell, from them for a long time back in London, who I think he said that, you know, this was disgraceful journalism. So that was disgraceful, but not the dossier, which apparently was scientific research. Reporting from Iraq is very, very difficult. I think we scratch at the surface, really. It is hugely difficult to move out and about in Baghdad. My skin colour helps tremendously, and some, you know, full of admiration for colleagues like Patrick Coburn, who are white, who who have much greater risks than I do. You don't see any white people in the streets of Baghdad, just you don't see anyone who's obviously African or Chinese, because anyone who is very different is a target. We had a guy, you may recall, one of our fixers came into the hotel and said that there was a Chinese guy, a backpacker, who had decided, apparently in the spur of the moment, that he'll visit Baghdad, and he jumped on a bus from Oman. And how he got through Fallujah, Ramadi, God knows, but he arrived in Baghdad and he was walking around trying to find a cheap hostel. Now, you know, we started making phone calls. Richard Lloyd Perry from the Times spoke to the Chinese embassy, and of course they knew nothing because we were wrong. The guy was Japanese, and 2 days later he was in an orange jumpsuit, and 3 days later he had been beheaded. I'm just telling you that to show the sheer difficulties of moving around. My time is ending. There's one other thing I'll say to you again. We don't even know what's happening to us most of the time. Our hotel, the Hamra, got blown up back in 2005. I was in my room when they blew it up, and I saw the room fly around me, and we still don't know who did it. It's the first time, if it was the insurgents who had carried out the bombing, about 30 people died there. But a lot of Iraqi officials, and some Americans, and some Brits, actually think that the order on the hit the Hamra was taken by a government minister who shall remain nameless because I have to go back there, who just got fed up with the Western media writing about death squads that he personally ran. We've got no idea whether it was him or whether it was the Sunni insurgents. I will end on that note because, you know, since we don't even know what's happening to us, I don't think we can very accurately describe what's happening to others in Iraq. So I appreciate, you know, that the reporting from Iraq is pretty imperfect, but I think one ought to realise that the constraints that journalists work under are pretty huge.